Observation Deck with Gordo, brought to us by A Number One Air.
Thanks, Miller Man. Well, I just can't look away, and we do this from time to time. When I examine bad dating stories from the P1s, and they're just so endlessly entertaining to me. I don't know why.
It's, you enjoy other people's misery.
No,
just say it.
No, it's more that it fascinates me that we as humans are social creatures. We have to get along, and we have to mate, and we have to reproduce. Yet, dealing with other humans is the hardest thing that we do. It does not come naturally to us.
Mm-hmm.
And how people just miss each other in plain sight all the time. Just can't get on the same page. So, this one comes to us from Anonymous J.
Okay.
He says a couple observations. His dating experiences were generally in the early aughts. He's married now. But he said a few observations. Number one, many girls would post their picture from their freshman year of college, and then they'd show up looking as if they could kickstart a 747. Okay. Now, come on.
Kickstart.
He said one girl got mad at me because I asked her if she wanted to have a drink, and she proceeded to tell me she's an alcoholic who's only 2 days sober.
Oh, well, how did he know?
Said that was a little red flag. Yeah, how is he supposed to know that? But then she tells you she's 2 days sober. And I mean, I feel bad for that girl. She's improving her life and everything. But you, as a guy just wading into that, may decide, I'll move on to the next world.
Yeah.
And then he said, here's the real winner. One girl I'd been chatting with online for a week, and she just had to meet me that weekend. She wanted to meet on Saturday evening, and I told her I already had commitments I couldn't get out of, but she wouldn't relent. So Jay figures out a way to squeeze in a meeting with her between his appointments. He says she was a school teacher with a 12-year-old daughter who sounded really intelligent in all our communications, so I was anxious to meet her. So when I met her at a local bar, she immediately weirded me out as she brought two friends with her, a couple that was never discussed or referenced or anything. So he's like, okay, fine. He said he toughed it out and it went okay and the conversation was decent. I'd rate the whole encounter a B+. Now you're probably saying, what's so wrong with that? Well, the unstable part came the next morning. I woke up Sunday morning to find an email from her in my inbox. And I'm thinking it's going to be a nice to meet you, let's do it again sometime sort of thing. No, it was a long, rambling message, probably 4 to 5 pages long. The timestamp on it was around midnight, so I'm assuming it came after a long night of drinking after I had left the bar. They stayed there. It covered her whole life, basically from conception to right up to that evening.
Jeez.
Her thoughts on why most men are garbage, why men can't be trusted, how hard her life has been, and why she'd usually rather be alone with her vibrator.
Huh. I thought that was pronounced a different way.
Vibrator?
Yeah.
Than to have to tolerate the company of a man. She told me about her stormy relationship with her 12-year-old daughter. She also told me how she had thought of ending it all and included a mock suicide note she had drafted to her daughter.
Wow.
Jeez. He says, let me repeat that. She thought about killing herself at one point and had written a note to her daughter, and she included the rough draft to me in her note to me.
She's got a lot of problems.
And she ended it all with a really poorly written, dirty poem to me. It was on the same creative level as there was once was a man from Nantucket. He said, I didn't know how to respond, so I just wrote, that's a whole lot of sharing this early. Let's tap the brakes a little. She was embarrassed and apologized for the rant, and she apologized for writing it while she was drinking.
Wow.
So he said, I took quite a break from the online dating scene after that.
God.
And isn't everybody, doesn't it seem like it's just a little small scratch away from just finding the crazy underneath?
Yes.
Everybody just is a little bit crazier than you think they are once you get to know them.
We're all a little crazy, yeah.
But it's amazing how crazy some people really are underneath.
Yeah, yeah, there's no normal. It's just a matter of what kind of crazy you're going to run into.
Right. All these people that seem to have it together, and then you find out this damaged, fragile creature underneath all that.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, well, I just thought that I was the only one that felt like I wasn't confident. And all these other people were confident.
Capital.
And then you find out that, no, they aren't. So that's one wild story of that. Have you guys been following the Twitter account of the supposedly inside the White House resistance?
No.
See, I don't understand this because I would think the White House, although they've alienated the FBI and the CIA, but I would think the White House would have the resources to find out who this is.
Well, how do you find out if, let's say it's two people or three people who actually know about it? You got to get one of them to turn.
Well, no, couldn't you go to Twitter?
Well, that's where they're tweeting.
I know, but couldn't you, as the White House,
go to the company,
go to the company and say, this is a matter of national security. Can you tell us who's doing this?
That's a good question.
Or shut down the account.
Yeah.
If they're using VPNs and Tor or all that stuff, you know, that hides.
What is that?
It's, I don't know, security experts say that's what you use to you know, make it. Yeah, well, not hack. It's just to use for privacy, if you want privacy from the government.
I would think at the very least, the president could go to Twitter and say, shut down their account. Shut down their page.
Right now.
Yeah.
Horrible.
And then Twitter would have to make a big public stand. And then would they want that? Would they want to show down with Trump?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it is interesting to see what they are saying on the inside. I wonder if it's all just made up. You know, it's a bunch of stuff like, you know, hey, Trump just yelled at so-and-so for this and such and whatever. You know, it doesn't paint a real favorable light, as you could imagine. Or is this a bunch of out-of-control libs making stuff up? But they don't make the thing so wild that it's unbelievable.
So it's just mainly him yelling at people?
No, it's stuff like, oh, gosh, what would it be? Like, he kind of did this and didn't know what the implication was. You know, it's a lot of scary stuff that kind of like he's in over his head, but you just, all you do is you smooth over anything with just confidence. You just claim something's true or you just do it anyway. And I think that's what's appealing about the guy is that it's the scariest thing about him, and it's the thing that satisfies people the most, is that he just doesn't conform to the rules. He just says, screw the rules. And if you support him and hate the rules already, it works. But I find it real interesting that we have this new way of a president communicating directly to the people, circumventing the press. And now you could possibly have resistance within the White House circumventing the White House and the press to speak directly to the people as well.
Yeah, every president until now has needed the press, but this is why he can call the press fake news and rip the press constantly, because he doesn't need the press. He's got Twitter.
He's got Twitter. That's right. And he's got the will of, you know, a lot of people who think that he's the truth teller and the press is just, you know, an arm of the Democratic Party or whatever.
So has Trump tweeted about this inside White House Twitter account?
Not that I've seen, and that seems weird to me.
Yeah. Like, wouldn't he be refuting it?
Yeah, wouldn't he be out there saying this is a fake account and Twitter ought to shut that down? I mean, he's tweeting about Nordstrom dropping Ivanka's line of clothing.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, the official POTUS account retweeted that.
That's weird.
Retweeted Donald Trump's private tweet, and they say, according to the resistance Twitter account, they say that Trump himself was the one who retweeted his own tweet from the official POTUS account, and they said that even senior staffers are a bit worried about this, that it's gotten to where he'll go after an American company for a personal reason using the official President of the United States account to do it on. Because he's a man that everything is personal to him, you know, and he can't separate what pisses him off with his job.
All right, Gordo, thank you. That's the ODEC 642 on the ticket. Muse in the News with Gordo, brought to us by D&M Leasing and All-Pro Foundation Repair.
Thank you, Strong Have and Good Goods. Come on, let's do some new. Don't you give me thumbs down. Don't you dare give me thumbs down.
Do what I want.
Boy, what if they did that on local news?
It's coming.
Good evening and welcome to Channel 8.
Yeah, and John McKay just giving thumbs down. Thumbs down whole time. All right. Let's get some news here. Okay, so we start off with Greg Abbott.
Abbott! Hey, Abbott!
That's his rallying cry. Yesterday, he threatened to bring the hammer down on Dallas County. That's right.
Yeah, well.
That's if it acts on this new resolution welcoming unauthorized immigrants. So Clay Jenkins, I think, was part of the four Democratic Dallas County commissioners who passed this resolution. And it made it's meant to make immigrants feel safe calling 911 and working with police, you know, cooperating with police on some investigation and sending their kids to school and things like that, even though they're illegal. Because that's the thing. You have a situation where if you're an illegal, let's say that you are an employed, but here in the country illegally.
How does that happen, by the way?
Don't
you have to give every employer's Social Security number?
I think there's somehow to get a Social Security number but still be illegal.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think. I'm not sure.
Hmm.
But then a lot of illegals also work for cash.
Yeah.
You know?
I get it, like, if you're part of a lawn crew or something like that.
Right, right. So if you see a crime, though, those people can't call 911, or some of them don't feel comfortable calling 911, mm-hmm. or relying on our, you know, our services that we need them to participate in order for us to function well. You know, we want their eyes on the streets, calling in things and that. But you got them scared, and so I guess these Democrats were trying to make them feel unscared. Mm-mm. No, we're not going to have any sanctuary cities around here. That's what Greg Abbott says, the Ticket's own Greg Abbott, by the way.
Yeah, that's right.
He said that
knew our names.
If anybody acts on that resolution to make Dallas a sanctuary city, if any sanctuary city policy is implemented in any way, the hammer will come down on them.
You know, I guess I understand both sides here. I understand our governor not wanting sanctuary cities, though. You can't. I mean, everybody's got to play by the same rules, right?
Please.
Or else that's going to lead to chaos.
Oh, George is blazing.
We have rules for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, the rule of law. But is America really rule of law?
Well,
it
differs.
To follow the rules.
It differs state to state and county to county, but we try to keep it somewhat uniform so that we have some form of order.
Remember when he was on our show, he said he didn't want Texas to be like California. He wants, and whatever that pertains to, whether it's mm-hmm. drilling or whatever, the same rules apply for Denton as Port Arthur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and hey, I get the idea of the rule of law, but don't we kind of lull ourselves to sleep at night with that familiar refrain, hey, we're a country of laws and so on. But then when you look at it, doesn't the application of the law seem to be kind of uneven, and people that we like, we go, well, I mean, yeah, but they didn't, you know.
Yeah,
if we agree with the person, it's like, you know, some people get off a lot lighter than other people, even though it's the mm-hmm. same law governing them. And we're okay with that as long as we like these people. We're not for them being gone after and prosecuted.
Hey, Austin is our capital. I don't mind them setting the policy, just like they don't mind it when Washington, D.C. says what's going to happen. Wait, they sometimes have a problem with Washington. Yeah.
I almost think that the thing that both the left and the right would hate the most is if someone came along and said, you guys have to be consistent.
Mm-hmm.
You can't cherry pick through all this and have one policy according to this principle, one policy according to this principle. You're going to have to be logically consistent across your whole platform. Both sides, that would drive them nuts. No, we just want to feel what we want to feel. Stop. I want feel. Give me feel. It's not a rule of law. It's a rule of feel.
And this is a very tough call because I understand the feel on the other side is, it makes sense. It's making our cities safer.
Mm-hmm.
It's making these people feel, you know, more a part of things, even though they're technically not a part of things, but for the betterment of the community to be able to report crimes and things like that. But in this case, I side with our governor because I think he's got to go by
the
rule
of
law and get everybody on the same page. And I'm just,
is it within the city's right to say we're not going to aggressively enforce this policy or that policy? Like, can the police departments make that determination that, hey, we're going to focus on speeders and not going to be a roundup squad?
I guess they can, maybe not officially.
Because with limited resources, don't we have to focus more on certain laws than other laws?
Yeah. I think every department does that.
Okay. Well, then that kind of flies in the face of, hey, rule of law, man. All rules enforced equally.
I just, in general, support our governor because I know that we're one poorly constructed ramp away from that moron Dan Patrick running the state.
Right, right. And, George, you bring up the good point, too, of us all hating government. Unless, aren't we supposed to hate Greg Abbott telling us what we're going to do here locally?
Yeah, because they shout at Washington, hey, we're not going to have Washington tell us what to do down here in Texas.
Right. And then are we here in Dallas going to say, well, we want liberal Austin to be telling us what to do?
Mm-mm.
I mean, it all falls apart.
Yeah.
And then, hey, I live in this particular house. Do I want someone in downtown Dallas telling me what to do way over here? All right. We need to get Dan Patrick on the show for Craig to have a...
Oh, God.
Well, I haven't finished the sentence.
He's a former radio guy, that Dan Patrick. He was a big talk show host in Houston.
You know what his bit was? He's famous for having a vasectomy on the air.
Live on the air.
Let's kick ass.
That's our lieutenant governor.
Right. Well, look what our president's famous for. He's famous for, you're fired and grab him by the pee.
Grab him by the p.
Oh, jeez.
It.
An Arizona man convicted for supporting the Islamic State and helping to plot an attack on that Prophet Muhammad cartoon contest that was going on in Garland. His attorney was wanting 6 years. Prosecutors wanted a life sentence. And he ends up getting 30 years. This guy apparently was in cahoots with the two dudes who went down there and started shooting up the place in Garland, and they ended up injuring one person, but they were shot dead by officers.
And how old is this guy?
This dude is 45.
So they more than split the difference. He almost gets a life sentence.
Yeah. His name is Abdul Malik Abdul Karim.
God, that sounds like a great center.
Can you do two Abduls?
Sure.
In
a name? I guess so.
Huh.
Abdul Malik Abdul Karim's got 32 tonight.
Abdul Malik Abdul Karim Madul Alik. He provided the guns to Elton Simpson and Nadir Sufi. And those were the guys that opened fire. Sufi. Stop making everybody being announced entering the game.
That's 3 fouls now on Elton Simpson.
Oh, he's about to have to leave the game. Yeah. So that guy gets 30 years. 30 years. Okay. Did it make you nervous, though, when anyone... I remember when they announced that event, I was thinking, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Good idea.
I'm not going.
That's kind of where I always let the terrorists win. They scare me with their... They're really offended by cartoons.
Yes.
Just terrorists hate cartoons. So let's just not...
That's what caused the shoot 'em up in Paris.
Yeah, that we had I Am Charlie. Mm-hmm. We were all Charlie or whatever we were supposed to say after that one. Which, once again, was our cheap clicktivism.
I know. We shade our profile picture on Twitter and we feel like we've done a hell of a lot.
And you know, that's what keeps any of these movements from being effective. Is because now we have more convenient ways to dissipate our emotion.
But we're not really getting involved.
No, we won't get involved, you know. We'll change our profile picture, or we'll do a march. We will do a march.
Mm-hmm.
Because, hey, let's go down there. Those are cool. Did you hear about it? They just started this idea. It started floating around on Wednesday, and we're going to do this Friday night. And then we do it Friday night, and then, God, that felt good. Where's cat video? I need cat video now.
What's funny on Netflix?
Right. Give Tinder. And so, yeah, we never do anything beyond that because we've already got it out of our system. We opened that emotional spit valve and went out there and marched, and then we're out of saliva now.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court nominee that Trump has put up, Judge Gorsuch, He actually, and this is refreshing, and I like this, Trump's still supporting him, of course. He called Trump's criticism of independent judges demoralizing and disheartening. You know, Trump was deriding that Seattle Circuit Court judge who blocked his travel ban, even referring to him as what we do on the air jokingly, as a so-called judge. So Trump kind of uses that, you know, adolescent type humor that we do. And I don't know if Trump was joking or not. And Gorsuch says, you know, this is demoralizing and disheartening, attacking the judiciary like this. Because I do think Trump thinks that it's the court's job to get out of his way, not to weigh whether something is legal that he's doing or make rulings on this or tell him what is right and what is wrong. Trump knows what's right and wrong, and judges who stand in the way of that are nothing but activist judges. Mm-hmm. We don't want that.
Bad hombres.
Sad.
You know, don't we need to at least give Trump a little credit for selecting Neil Gorsuch? Because from all my lib friends, they say, yeah, it's not a bad pick.
Right.
You know, if it's going to be a Trump pick, they feared the worst. But this guy apparently has a great resume, seems to be have a reputation for being a really fair guy. He may not be completely in line with what the liberals would like, but they say for a Trump nominee, he's pretty good. He's about as good as they can get.
He was in line with Scalia, who passed on. Mm-hmm. They have a very similar ideology.
Yeah.
Really? That's like one of the worst, right? Antonin Scalia was the guy that passed out in Texas?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He died in Texas, not just passed out.
He passed out and then died.
You may want to turn down Sean's mic in there.
George.
Jeez, that was
George?
A prop.
Come on, George.
Part of the show.
Adding to the conversation.
Scalia, you know that, and I think there were some truthers about his death.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm sure.
We got to have truthers about everything.
Mm-hmm.
When did the term truther first start? Was that Obama birth certificate?
Yeah.
Or was it 9/11? I think it's 9/11.
Yeah, I think you're right. 9/11. Yeah, because there were the truthers who said that it was an inside job.
Right. And before that,
there's a lot of millennials who believe that.
Hmm.
Jeez.
I'm telling you.
Sounds like you have inside information.
I do have inside information.
It sounds like you've had a lot of arguments with one of your sons.
not just my sons. I've talked to some others.
Why did they latch on to that?
I don't know.
Of all the
just watch
fun
it.
Rabbit
just watch
hole
it.
Conspiracies to go down.
Just
why
watch it,
one?
Okay?
Just
yeah,
watch
what is the
inconvenient truth? Just watch it.
No, that's the Al Gore one, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, right. What's the other one?
I forget the name of that. I've watched it before. The
Fahrenheit 9/11?
Yeah.
I think
yeah,
so.
That's it.
Yeah.
Was that the Michael Moore documentary? Yeah. So what is the general thought? If it was America that did this to ourselves, why?
Just watch it.
There's a lot of stuff, man. There's just a lot of stuff.
Well, that doesn't give me enough information.
It's because of the multinational corporations. what about the multinational corporations?
Who had the most to gain?
Who had the most to gain? Okay, yeah, but I'm asking who is that and why
follow
do they do it?
Follow the money.
You just got to follow the money, man. You just seem to be making me chase you one after the other trying to ask you the same question over and over again.
It's an international conglomerate.
What?
9/11.
Hey! And you know that's the way those people work, Giorgio. Have you tried to at least argue with these?
Oh, yeah. I've had discussions with them before, and, you know, it's, yeah.
See, I always do that, too. I always ask simple questions like, okay, but why would they do that? Well, so they could do so-and-so. And I'd say, but couldn't they do so-and-so a lot easier this and such way? Yeah, but they, you know, they stood to profit off of 9/11. But wait, I mean, address this idea like they didn't even have to do 9/11 in order to accomplish that same objective.
They'll eventually turn 40
and what?
In reverse field.
And discover, let's see what. Oh, Wikipedia Occam's razor. Oh, this is an interesting idea. All right. In other news, let's see. Oh, C.J. Wilson, you know he retired?
He did.
Yeah.
The Rangers own.
Uh-huh. And you know what he's doing now?
Racing cars.
There's no telling. Flying jets, going to be an astronaut. Going to be a movie star.
So do you want to hear a little bit of
there's so many
CJ
things
Wilson
he could
where's
do.
Where's the
pilot?
Do you have
here's Mama.
Music?
He's pro sports' biggest Chris of all time.
Yes. And we love listening to him because he always says something incredibly douchey.
Yeah.
He's like, and oddly enough, I believe Chris was on our show before we were aware of how Chris C.J. Wilson was.
Yeah.
All right, listen, there's a local interview.
Wilson, veteran Major League Baseball pitcher, and C.J. here. You're in Fresno now. Tell a little bit of everybody what's going on here.
Well, I'm a rookie car dealer now, so I'm here at Porsche, Audi, and BMW Fresno. I'm the new dealer, and... You know, I've been a dealer for a couple years, but I had the opportunity to purchase the store from the previous owner, and I was like, wow, great brands. Why not? So I just finished moving in. I missed the Super Bowl because I was actually unpacking boxes at my house down the street, and now I'm here to stay. So I'm just really looking forward to learning the community and selling cars and making a lot of people happy.
A lot of the sports fans will know you from your baseball background, maybe not so much from your racing background. How much is C.J. Wilson Racing a part of your life now, and how big, and when did you get into it?
Yeah, I've been in racing since I was a kid. I started karting when I was probably like six or something, going to dirt track events my
karting.
Whole life. My dad was on a pit crew and got me into it. And now it's going to be a big deal. You know, now it's I don't have to hide anymore. There's no contract violations to worry about or anything like that. So we race Porsches in the IMSA series, and so we're looking to kind of work our way forward. And this is a big step for us.
So he's gotten a lot sweeter now.
I got a prediction. He's not going to like Fresno. That is 2.5 hours from nowhere. I think he needs.
We wish him well in his new endeavor.
I think he needs L.A. or San Francisco or Vegas or Miami or Dallas.
Didn't he say he could land a 747?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. My birthday's. News correspondent Roger Mudd is 89. Didn't
always,
we all giggle about his name when we were kids?
Always.
Carole King is 75.
It's a greatness.
Joe Pesci is 74.
Boy,
greatness.
He is.
George, what's the role you remember him most in?
JFK.
Okay.
Or Home Alone.
The boy's got a couple.
He's great in both.
And he was also in, what was it?
Goodfellas.
Guy was great in Goodfellas.
Boy, he was.
Joe Ely is 70.
Greatness.
Mia Farrow, 72.
Hmm.
Travis Tritt, 54. All right. Wowie today. Which one would you? 65 and 41. Hmm. 65 and 41.
I'll play the odds and go 41.
Okay. Craig, you'll be making love to Vladimir Guerrero, who's 41.
Hey.
All right.
We can talk a little Ranger baseball.
And George, you get an evening with Danny White, who turns
my God.
It's a torturous
did you
thing.
Win big?
He is officially of retirement age now.
Happy birthday to the original D&M Hall of Famer.
Listen to the music as George is being ceremonially disrobed.
Happily.
Yes.
Happy birthday to the great
purification bath.
Danny White.
I want to be not
funny. All right, that's Muse 733 on the ticket. It's Gordo's Corner, brought to us by Baker Brothers Plumbing and Air. And by load-bearing wall pros.
You know, for 2 days in a row, we're going to have special in-studio guests in the corner. That's very exciting. Yesterday, we had the actor who's performing at the Wind Spear. And today, we're going to have another. We have actually multiple special guests in the studio. We're going to get to them in just a moment. But just a quick hit in the world of sports. Did you see the news that Bob Costas, who has been the face of NBC Sports for decades, is stepping down?
Slap, slap, slapping sounds.
from hosting the Olympics, and Mike Tirico is going to take over.
Hmm.
He announced this morning on the Today Show.
Do you think they promised that to Tirico when he came over? That was part of the deal? You'll eventually do hosting of the Olympics?
You asking me?
I was asking Junior.
I don't think so.
You're a jerk.
But I think they must have put it out there for him. I think Tirico went to NBC because he knew at some point he would take over for Al Michaels on Sunday Night Football. Because Al's in his, what, late 70s? Mid-70s?
Yeah,
early 90s.
Early to mid.
71.
And 71. Sorry,
Al. Not doing well.
Sorry,
Al. Fernando.
But he knew at some point he'd get that gig, and then they may have said, and at some point we expect Bob Costas to move on, mm-hmm. and that can be yours as well.
Costas turns 65 next month.
So,
65.
If Bob Costas is stepping down, that's Bob Costas' decision, right? Especially at 65?
It's got to be, right?
It has to be. They're not
forcing him out. What has he done wrong?
Nothing.
And he's not losing it, is he?
No, not at all. He's still great.
Well, how old's Mike Tirico? 30?
50?
He's probably 50.
Tirico's in his late 40s.
Yeah.
So say he's around 50. They're not getting that much younger at the position.
15 or 16 years. It's...
Yeah, but if your lead guy's not losing it yet, then why do you have to make the change?
I don't know, Gordon. I don't work at NBC.
I'm not. No, we're trying to think this through together. It's not adversarial.
Right. I don't know.
All right. So Three God bless.
50.
50.
Yeah.
Told you.
So I guess my question was, why make the change?
I think it's clearly they're not making a change. Bob has decided he's done. Enough.
Okay.
That right. has to be it, because there's no way they would sub out Tirico for Costas with Costas still in his prime. No way.
All right. We have special in-studio guests, and we always love it when these guys come up here. Their spokesman will be Chris from Heritage Auctions.
Yay. Yay.
And you guys have brought up some items, and I didn't know what you guys were bringing up here. At first, I was really excited because I've been meaning to contact you guys about, you have a couple of Larry McMurtry's typewriters, including the ones, the two that he wrote Lonesome Dove on. Opening bid, $10,000 on that.
Whoa.
I know, and I'm like the typewriter guy in the Metroplex that I know of.
Give him an undercut bid.
I don't think that's the way bidding works, Giorgio. You don't bid lower. But but anyway, yeah, I'm going to try to see those at some point when you guys have that auction back in up in March.
Up in March.
But Chris, you guys have brought in some things today, and I see you've already laid out one that I'm excessively interested in.
Oh, man.
And I'm going to ask you to start there, because is there any doubt whose outfit this is laying on our broadcast table?
No doubt.
It's a white leather jumpsuit with red, white,
Elvis
and blue.
Presley?
It's either, and with a big E on the belt, and it's Evel Knievel.
Absolutely.
You have three huge Evel Knievel fans here.
Oh, my God.
There are a lot of Evel Knievel fans out there. He was an icon and really started out, created the
superhero. The superhero.
Daredevil. Yeah, icon. So, this is a little bit of crossover from sports and entertainment for us. But, yeah, this is the most recognizable jumpsuit of the 70s. And this is his motorcycle leathers. These are one of the first ones that he had created in 1972, 1973.
Look at that. It's so ridiculously awesome.
Outrageous is that.
Look at the big EK on the front of it. That is great.
On the sleeves, you've got the EK on the sleeves.
So now how did you guys get a hold of this? Is this a private collector? Is this the Knievel family?
This is coming from the Knievel family.
Oh,
yeah, this
my
is directly
goodness.
From the family.
And what did he jump in that? Do you know?
So believe it or not, there's not great footage of all his jumps.
Yeah.
But he has great footage of some of them. So the first one we were able to definitively tie this to is in 1973 at the LA Coliseum. He did a jump there, and right before that jump, to promote it, he appeared on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Wearing this outfit?
He was wearing a coat and tie on Carson, but he did...
This is so great, because you can't tell whether this is from Elvis Presley, Evel Knievel, or an astronaut.
Right. What's the patch on the shoulder? What does that say?
It's one of his sponsors. I think one of them is Olympia?
Olympia beer. Light Olympia beer. Mm-hmm. And this says Harley Davidson number one on the other side.
Okay.
And the outfit looks like he may have had a spill in it here on this side.
Absolutely.
And he scraped himself up here.
It looks a little small, but I think I can fit into that. Hang on just a second.
Okay. George, try to
let me get my first leg in there.
George is a 53 long.
Oh,
oh
no, George.
Just ripped the leather.
Sorry about
there.
We can patch that.
Yeah, we can,
we can patch that.
We
sorry
got
about
duct
that.
Tape. All right, so he wore it at the LA Coliseum jump in 73, right?
And then the last one we recorded him was actually here at in Grand Prairie, I think. Later in the same year, either early,
right.
I think it was late 73.
Huh.
Yeah. And so he wore that from 72, 73. It's one of his first incarnations of this famous leathers that he had made. Obviously, it's for protection for any of the falls he would take. And this one saw quite a bit of action, as you can see. There's certainly some scuffing, and so he took the
I just watched that documentary that Johnny Knoxville produced. It was really good.
Yeah.
On Evel Knievel. That's amazing. So how much is this opening for?
Right now, it's about $30,000. I think our estimate on it's $100,000 plus.
Wow.
It's the first one that's ever been offered to the public.
And so this, and people can see all this at ha.com, right? Your
that's
website.
Right. Yeah.
You can see the pictures of what we're looking at. And I'm going to try to tweet a few pictures of that suit here in just a few moments. So this could possibly go for over $100,000.
Yeah, that's our estimate on it. It's the first lot in the auction. It's getting a lot of interest. And as you said, I mean, there's a lot of Hollywood interest in Evel Knievel.
You know, because all the people who grew up and he was their hero, now they're of the age where they have money and they could spend on something like this. Yeah. You can buy part of your childhood
there. I mean, I know I had, for my older brother, the Evel Knievel toy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think most of us did.
Hell yeah. Now, was there any dissension within the Knievel family? Like, did you get this on consignment? They offer it to you, and then all of a sudden, Robbie's brother calls you up and says, "Hey, man, Robbie just stole that thing out of my room."
No, it actually comes from Kelly Knievel, his Robbie's brother, and Kelly worked it out with his dad and owns the stuff outright. Yeah,
that's fascinating. That's awesome. What else you got here? What is in front of you here?
Well, in this second piece, actually, you know, while
is that Evil's cane?
Well, Evel Knievel.
Oh yeah,
he didn't wear the leathers on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show. He did bring on his walking stick.
I just watched this interview just about 2 weeks ago.
This is the
famous that's the cane that he walked out with.
And look, there he is, his famous SI cover, and he's holding that cane.
Yep.
Look at that. Isn't that great?
Why did he need a cane? Because his legs were all messed up from jumps?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. To help him walk, the walking stick.
But I think it was just an affectation. You know?
Oh, okay.
Cool. It helps with the show, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And there's actually the walking stick opens up. And there's three flasks inside.
Oh, he kept his liquor in there.
No.
Dang it. Look at that.
Evel.
You think that's classy, George?
He didn't take a couple of pops before he would jump, would he?
You know,
I would.
They talked about it on the Carson show, and he said he didn't, but there's firsthand accounts that he would take a couple of shots.
You'd have to loosen yourself up a little bit.
Yeah, join me for a after hours drink.
This is kind of like my public speaking theory. Just have a couple of pops.
Evel had his hand right here, George. Look at that.
It's very powerful.
The top of his cane. Can you feel the power radiating?
You got a little diamond studded motorcycle rider here on the top as well.
Gosh.
Diamond studded motorcycle.
Oh, I love White Trash with Money.
He and Elvis were very much alike, weren't they? From uniform to
Of course.
He was a
trashiness factor.
Yeah.
He was a showman. Now, while researching this, we actually saw some of the first jumps he did, and he came out to do an interview in a coat and tie, and I said to Mike, that just doesn't look right. You know?
Right.
So he was a showman. That
he was
of
off brand at that point.
Absolutely.
He later got on target with the jumpsuits and all. That's great. So what is this one going to open for, is Kane?
This one we have estimated at $20,000+, and actually it's getting a lot of action. It's at $17,000 right now, and we've got 3 weeks to go in the auction.
I'm going to try to bring back the Kane look. I think that would look good. Don't you think so, George?
I think Norm already has.
Well, his is for actual...
I'm sorry. That's it!
Yeah, no, it looks pretty cool.
Medical reasons, George. Way to go.
I'm trying to bring the room down.
All right, what else do we have here, Chris?
Well, this is a little bit more of traditional sports collectible here. There's a really neat story behind it. A young boy in Massachusetts named Thomas Jacob in the 1930s collected stamps. And 1939 was the 100-year centennial of the game of baseball. It's also the year they opened Cooperstown Hall of Fame, so they are issuing stamps to commemorate it. Well, this young man had the idea that he was going to write the Hall of Fame, and he was going to create some autograph pieces. So he wrote the Hall of Fame, and the Hall of Fame, this is kind of cool, they wrote him back. He asked for I would like the addresses of all the members that you're inducting. So the Hall of Fame writes him back with Babe Ruth's address, Ty Cobb's address, Grover Cleveland Alexander's address, the whole nine yards. So he starts writing these guys to get him to sign his stuff. Well, he had him sign a 1939 Hall of Fame induction piece, and he also wanted to do a most valuable player for American League and National League. So this one goes from 1922 to 1939, and he sent letters with this actual piece of paper to all these players and asked them to sign it on the years that they won.
Wow.
They got it back each and every time.
Can you imagine how risky that is once you've collected 6 or 10 autographs and you're mailing it out?
May not come back.
And just trusting that it's going to come back.
You tell me when you would duck out and say, okay, I'm just keeping the piece of paper now. It's valuable enough. Walter Johnson.
Right there. I'm ducking out.
Yeah, you may be done there.
Babe Ruth.
Wow. Definitely done.
George, what is that? George Burns? Is that right? For 1926, it would be this is American League. Then we got, is that Lou Gehrig?
Yeah. Holy cow.
And I'm trying to see if I can just, here's another Lou Gehrig here. Lou Gehrig signed it twice in 3 years' time. Lou Gehrig again, 4 times for Lou Gehrig. Who else do we have on here? Who is that? Frank?
Tanana? There's
Jimmy Fox. There's Jimmy Fox.
Hank Greenberg. Not Frank Tanana.
There's Joe DiMaggio. Yeah.
Whoa.
My goodness. Look at this thing.
So that is it's basically every MVP from 22 to 39. But the really interesting thing is I have another letter here. This is the letter that he actually sent to Lou Gehrig, and he says, "Lou, you know, this is what I'm doing. I'm creating this MVP sheet. I have it in my records that you won the MVP 2 times." Lou Gehrig writes him back
on
the back here. It says, "Dear Tom, I don't know where you got your data, but I have trophies in my home to show that I was MVP in 27, 31, 34, and 36. Mm-hmm. It's the first time I've seen Gehrig kind of get salty. He has this he has this reputation for being so nice. And this, what's interesting about this, and he signs it, best wishes, Lou Gehrig. And then he writes, check with the Sporting News. Now, in fact, the fact of the matter is they were both correct. Because Gehrig won the MVP twice as awarded by the sports writers and won it 4 times as awarded by the Sporting News. And those were the trophies he was presented with. So he actually took the piece of paper and signed it 4 times and then wrote that letter back to him.
Wow.
Those are great autographs, too. I mean, they took great care in autographing that.
They
good
did.
Penmanship.
Yeah, great penmanship.
Yeah, and he actually sent it to them covered in wax paper. And some of them actually signed over the wax paper, so I think that's why one of the guys wasn't. That might be the other sheet, the Hall of Fame sheet. Some of them.
This is fantastic.
George, hand it here. Don't you're hogging
it. Take it out of the plastic just for a second.
Don't hog it. Give it. Oh,
oh no! Oh,
sorry, I thought you were letting it go.
We can tape it. It'll be fine. It'll be fine.
That's wacky. All right, and then this is
how much is this going to go for? By the way,
we've got that one estimated at $40,000 plus.
Oh no!
Nice.
Well, maybe 30.
Well, now with the tear, we'll
39.9.
After we tape it back up, we can get it back up to about 35.
Yeah, sorry about that.
All right, now you got a number 7. Is that a jersey or a sweatshirt? Number 7 for New York.
Yeah. So number 7, New York. That's iconic. We know that's Mickey Mantle.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is Mickey Mantle's gray road flannel from 1968, his last season. And this is actually from the last season that, from the very end of that season, from September. And this has a really cool story behind it as well. And Mantle actually tells it. We've got it listed with the jersey that's on the website at ha.com. There's a video of Mantle talking about this particular jersey. He wore this in his last road game at Detroit. And it was in mid-September 1968. Detroit had already clinched, and they were going to the playoffs. And he was facing a young ace by the name of Denny McClain.
Whoa!
And it was his last at bat. They're in the 8th inning at Detroit, and McClain comes up to the catcher and says that this is Mantle's last at bat. Is my mic out?
Yeah. I can hear you.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Did your ears go out or something?
Yeah. This is Mantle's last at bat in Detroit. And so he said, throw him a fastball straight up the middle. And Mantle didn't know if he was messing with him or not because he heard him say that. So the first pitch comes in, belt high fastball, meatball right down the middle. So Mantle says, all right, they're serving it up for me. Second swing, he fouls it off. Third swing, fastball right down the middle, home run. It's 535th of his career. And he talks about how he was rounding the bases. McClain winked at him.
He's how tipped cool his, is that?
He tipped
never
his
heard
hat
that before.
While he was wearing this jersey here.
While he's wearing this jersey, because he donated this jersey to a gentleman named Tom Cattell, who ran the Mickey Mantle Museum in Cooperstown, New York. And so he signed it to Tom on the shoulder. You can see it there.
Yeah.
And Cattell wrote a letter of provenance with it. When he eventually
see if you can slip into it, Gordo. I think it's about your size.
I've put on a few pounds.
Just try
no, don't,
try
don't,
this.
Don't.
Oh, Jesus. Do you need that sleeve, or can you sell it without it?
I think we can sew that back on there. I think.
You know what's amazing to me is that this is wool.
It seems hot.
Could you imagine wearing that in August?
Yeah. Wool was the performance fabric of choice back in the day because supposedly it wicked moisture and it kept you cooler.
Why do people believe that? What a bunch of sheep who would wear a bunch of wool.
Sounds and feels so uncomfortable.
And how much is that going to go for, Chris, do you think?
That one's estimated at $700,000 plus.
Wow! The mackerel. Yeah.
Now, just to give you an idea, we sold a Mickey Mantle rookie card, really high grade condition one, in November for $1.1 million. Now, You know, obviously there's a lot of high-grade card collectors, and this was a unique condition rarity. But there's probably, this is all original with great provenance. There's probably less than 10 all original Mickey Mantle game worn jerseys for my money.
Really?
I'd want something that the athlete wore.
Yeah. Especially for the final home run, awesome. Too.
And absolutely. You know what's kind of interesting is that usually when an autograph is personalized, doesn't that take the value down a little bit?
If it's solely for an autographed item, it does, unless your name matches. But typically, right. Yeah, the value goes down. But for something like this where it adds provenance and you know exactly the chain of custody, it really helps.
Now, this next item I think is really interesting. This is Tom Brady's Super Bowl 51 jersey. How did you guys get this so quickly?
Oh, you know, this was a really shady character came into the office yesterday and just dropped
sports
it
comedy. We're doing some sports like comedy that. Around here.
I like that a lot.
Thank you. All right, do you have what is your last most impressive item?
Well, this one's kind of fun. This is a gold medal from the 1972 Olympics. It actually came to us from Olga Corbett, who really kind of popularized gymnastics in the Summer Olympics. She won 4 golds and 2 silvers in the 72 Munich and 76 Montreal Olympics. So a lot of people that were watching Olympics in the 70s remember this particular Olga and what she did in those Olympics.
What's going on the back of this thing? That's an interesting looking...
Yeah, that's how they did the 72 gold medals.
It's kind of odd. You can see some penis on these guys here. What? Back. Well, you'll just have to see it, Giorgio. Okay.
I think it's an homage to the original Greek Olympics, which were, I think it was clothing optional in those Olympics.
Yeah, probably so. I didn't think
go
they
back to that.
Invented clothes at that time.
But these come to us directly from Olga. We're working with her to offer her collection. She's got her memories. She wants her fans to have an option to purchase these. The interesting
thing
is,
they own the gold medals.
Yes.
Isn't it like the Oscars that do the thing where you don't actually own the statue?
Right, right.
You can't.
That's correct.
You can have it as a, and your family, I guess, can keep it after you die, but it can't be sold necessarily.
After a specific year in the 30s, I think it was maybe late 30s or early 40s, they decided that they didn't ever want the Oscars to be on the secondary market. So I think when you win an Oscar, you have to sign a sheet that says if you ever sell it or the Oscars, the Academy has the option to buy it back for a dollar. I think that's,
really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
But gold medals are different, obviously.
Right.
They're your own property.
Right. Exactly. They won them. They own them. The interesting thing is, so we're offering 5 medals of hers. She won 6, and one of them went missing. It was in a museum in Moscow, and it disappeared. So it might be in Putin's collection next to
Robert
Kraft's
Super Bowl.
Bowl
right.
Wow.
Those are awesome. All right, HA.com, if people want to see these items, and I still have a few more pictures to tweet out about this, and we thank you guys for coming up here, as always.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And let me know when you can let me come see those Larry McMurtry typewriters.
Will do.
Yeah, I'll get them in shape
for
you.
He wants to undercut bid.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Harry.
Good stuff.
Hawkins.
Thank you, guys. Yeah.